From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Gore and Occidental Petroleum. The vice president is being questioned about his ties to the oil giant, which is planning to drill in the ancestral territory of Colombia, the Uwa peoples. Also, the UN increases its presence in the Congo to monitor a ceasefire agreement. And are affluent white boys getting an unfair advantage on the SATs by claiming that they're dyslexic? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 10 of the internationally condemned resettlement camps in Burundi will be dismantled, this according to the country's foreign minister. He told the UN Security Council the effort would begin, quote, in the coming days. 58 camps were built to clear the countryside of an estimated 350,000 Hutu civilians, leaving insurgents from the tribe exposed to pursuit by the Tutsi-led army. More than 200,000 people have died in Burundi's civil war since 1993. On-again, off-again peace negotiations between the rivals resumed last weekend, mediated by former South African President Nelson Mandela. New controversies erupted in Zimbabwe as President Robert Mugabe chose February 12th and 13th for a national referendum on his proposed new constitution. But he drew heavy fire from critics for inserting new clauses into the final draft of the charter. If approved, they would hold Britain responsible for compensating Zimbabwe's white farmers whose land is confiscated for resettlement by poor blacks. If Britain refused, the whites would go unpaid because Zimbabwe's government would bear no obligation to compensate them. Whites still own one-third of the most productive land in the former British colony. The scandal surrounding the main opposition party in Germany took a tragic new turn with the discovery that one of its financial officers apparently has committed suicide. The news caused leaders of the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU, to ask for a break in Parliament's inquiry into the scandal. Earlier, CDU chief Wolfgang Schäuble appeared to win little sympathy as he apologized to legislators for the party's style of accepting funds in violation of campaign finance laws. Switzerland said today it has frozen $645 million in a money laundering probe into bank accounts belonging to the late Nigerian dictator Sani Abacha and his associates, and warned that there was more to come. A Swiss federal police spokesperson told Reuters the total included $95 million frozen in the past few days at seven banks in the Swiss banking hubs of Geneva and Zurich. Switzerland announced late last year it had frozen $550 million in bank accounts belonging to Abacha, whose sudden death in 1998 opened the way for the return of democracy in Nigeria. The discovery of Abacha's ill-gotten gains almost 2 years after Switzerland introduced a stricter money laundering law raises questions about the credibility of government efforts to crack down on dirty money. Abacha was long supported by the United States. Hundreds of dock workers clash with police in Charleston, South Carolina, over the unloading of a Danish cargo ship by non-union hands. At least six people were hurt, eight others were arrested. Members of the International Longshoremen's Association had marched to the port where the freighter was being guarded by some 600 police in anticipation of a protest. The incident followed one earlier this month in which ILA members were also involved. A lower court ruling that prospective jurors cannot be disqualified because they don't speak English was upheld by New Mexico's Supreme Court. An attorney for the state said procedures now will be set up to accommodate non-English-speaking jurors. An attorney representing Missouri inmates who were abused in Texas jails says he hopes a $2.2 million settlement will teach state officials some lessons. The settlement wraps up all state and federal lawsuits filed or contemplated by any of about 2,100 prisoners sent from Missouri to Texas from 95 to 97 under the Texas Cell Lease Program. Capital Corrections Resources, Inc., a private jail management company, will contribute $2.1 million, the limit of its insurance coverage to the settlement. The rest will be paid by other defendants, including the company that transported the inmates to Texas. The state of Missouri admitted no liability and will not contribute to the settlement. In negotiations, the state stuck to its policy of never paying to settle any prison claims, even, it said, if they are meritorious. The inmates will share $1.1 million with their portion, depending on the severity of the injuries that they suffered. A Marine private who refused to finish a series of anthrax vaccinations has been honorably discharged after his mother became sick with worry about the inoculations. James O'Neill was discharged Tuesday at the Marine base at Quantico, Virginia. He's returned to his parents' home in Rochester Mills, Pennsylvania.
Sure what the balance held, I touched my belly overwhelmed by what I had been chosen to perform. But then an angel came one day, told me to kneel down and pray, for unto me a man child would be born. Oh, this crazy circumstance, I knew his life deserved a chance.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. A very interesting exchange between Senator Helms and the members of the United Nations yesterday, where Senator Helms had the audacity to appear before the UN to basically scold them for the way that the United States has been treated by the United Nations. But the delegates apparently gave him tit for tat and challenged a lot of Senator Helms' claims.
It was the first time, actually, a U.S. senator has ever addressed the U.N. Security Council. But when you talk about Helms, I think about Burton, the Helms-Burton law. And it looks like the grandmothers of Elian Gonzalez may be headed up to pick up their grandchild, both grandmothers, both the mother who died on her way to Cuba, on her way from Cuba to the United States, as well as Elian's father's mother. And the reason I think Burton is interesting right now is every time I turn on the television, I see another picture of Elian getting a present. I don't know how many Mickey Mouses he's gotten. You know, he's gone to Disneyland, etc. But I think more important than showing all these gifts that the little boy is getting here is the camera should be focused on what's greasing the pockets of U.S. politicians. We've talked about Vice President Gore getting more than $300,000 from the right-wing Miami Cuban-American community. This is very significant. George W. Bush has gotten even more from them, but I think it does affect what Gore says about the Elian case. Well, Dan Burton of Indiana has gotten the vast majority of his campaign money, not from his own district, but from the Cuban-American community in Miami, which might well explain why he issued a subpoena to this six-year-old boy to keep him in the United States. I don't know how much of this is ideology anymore. I think we're talking pure money.
Well, there's no doubt that the our government's fixation with continuing this this Cold War against Cuba, while we openly trade and encourage most favored nation status for China and openly encourage trade with Vietnam, with which we fought a war where 55,000 Americans and 2 million Vietnamese were killed, shows that there's something else at work here than pure ideology.
Well, today we are going to be following the money trail in another case, and that is in the case of Vice President Gore and Occidental Petroleum. Environmentalists and human rights activists are accusing the vice president of hypocrisy over his shareholding in Occidental Petroleum, a company that plans to drill in Colombia's rainforests over the objections of local indigenous communities. Gore has targeted the environmental and human rights vote as part of his election campaign and was rated last week as the most knowledgeable presidential candidate on green issues by the League of Conservation Voters. But the UWA Defense Working Group, which represents the UWA indigenous group of northeastern Colombia, says Gore is inextricably linked with Occidental Petroleum, the U.S. oil giant that plans to start drilling on its ancestral lands in the next few months in search of an estimated 1.5 billion barrels of oil. The UWA have been campaigning for years to stop the drilling, but Gore's connections to Occidental sprang to the headlines this week with a Financial Times piece about environmentalists' request to the vice president that he call for Occidental to abandon their drilling plans in Colombia. Gore, by the way, owns up to $500,000 of the company's stock. And he's also facing heat for his involvement in the sale by the Clinton administration of tens of thousands of acres of oil-rich, publicly owned land to Occidental in 1997. The area is known as Elk Hills and is located in Bakersfield, California. It's also known as an ancestral land for Native American communities. Now, two prior Republican presidents, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, had attempted to put Elk Hills on the auction block, but backed down because of fierce opposition. It was President Clinton, under the advice of Vice President Gore, who approved the deal to let oil companies buy some of the reserve, pushing a bill through Congress that made it possible to sell the government's interests in the 47,000-acre Elk Hills Reserve to Occidental Petroleum for $3.65 billion. It was the largest privatization of federal land in the country's history, and it tripled Occidental's reserves overnight. We're joined right now by two people to talk about Vice President Gore's connection to Occidental. Peter Eisner is with the Center for Public Integrity, which just put out the book, The Buying of the President 2000. And we're on the line from the Berkeley area with Steve Kretzman, who is right now the coordinator of the UWA working group. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Thanks.
Let's start with Peter Eisner. Peter Eisner, can you talk about first Elk Hills?
Yes, indeed. Elk Hills is, besides all of the description that you gave, it's also interesting because it's part of what became known infamously in the 1920s as the Teapot Dome scandal, which involved the Elk Hills field and also the Teapot Dome field outside of Casper, Wyoming, which the predecessor of Atlantic Richfield Corporation attempted to buy by bribing the Secretary of the Interior in 1922. We've heard of the Teapot Dome scandal, but that's the background to it. So it's been a sacred cow, let's say, in American politics for most of the 1900s. The interesting thing about it is that, indeed, as you say, that subsequent administrations were not willing to sell it because the United States was getting good money from leasing parts of the fields for oil development. And suddenly, in 1996, as part of Vice President Gore's good government and business work, the National Performance Review, which he widely touted as reinventing government, he inserted the possibility that the Elk Hill Reserve be sold in part, and President Clinton went along with it.
Well, I'd like to ask Steve Kretzman, who is heading to New Hampshire today to begin organizing a campaign on Gore's environmental record, that we talked to the vice president's press office yesterday, and although they didn't come on the show, they did raise some issues. One is that they claimed that there was an open bidding process on the land, and that Occidental merely was the highest bidder, so that there was no attempt, although they acknowledged that the vice president recommended the sale of the land, that there was no attempt or chance to be able to rig the vote or rig the bid for Occidental. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that you need to look at the long history of connections in between Gore and Occidental to really understand the relationship fully. I don't think there is, at the moment, hard evidence that Gore actually maneuvered it inside to make sure that Occidental got the bid properly. However, he certainly wasn't in a position to do so and has an abiding financial interest in doing so. He owns up to $500,000 in Occidental stock. He stands to profit greatly not only from the sale of Elk Hills, but also if Occidental discovers the 1.5 billion barrels of oil on UWA land. This whole issue, whether you take the Elk Hills angle on it or you look at the UWA people in Colombia, it's a chance for Al Gore to tell us all whether or not he stands for his convictions for the environment or his connections to big oil. And that's really what this whole thing is all about right now.
Now, Steve, you're a consultant to the UWA campaign of Amazon Watch, and you're headed to New Hampshire. Why?
We're headed to tell Al Gore that he absolutely needs to make a decision and take a stand on this and needs to intervene on behalf of the UWA. Just this morning, we've heard that 5,000 Colombian troops have invaded UWA territory and surrounded 400 peaceful protesters, the UWA, who were sitting on Occidental's drilling site in a nonviolent protest to stop the drilling from going forward. That's new news as of this morning. So this is really a truly urgent situation, and it's one that we want to make sure that Al Gore understands that if he doesn't intervene, it's a possibility that he's going to be profiting from what could amount to a genocide in Colombia. He really needs to get on this and make his voice known immediately.
Well, the Gore people are claiming that there are divisions among the UWA in terms of what to do, and that it's not clear-cut what's the right side on this issue.
Yeah, there's absolutely no divisions among the UWA. They've been completely consistent for years in saying that they want absolutely no oil drilling on their land, and that they prefer indeed collective suicide. They have previously threatened to jump off of a cliff if oil drilling went forward to going forward with oil drilling. And now they're saying that they prefer the Colombian government to come in and wipe them out to allowing permitting oil. So it's quite a dire situation.
Steve Kretzmann, I was speaking to an administration official who wants to remain unnamed yesterday, but was called by the White House to give me background. I thought it was interesting how things work. You call the campaign. We called the Gore campaign to be on the show in Iowa, to be on from New Hampshire, to be on from Nashville, the headquarters of Gore's campaign, and also Washington. But they all said no. In Iowa, they said, this is not our priority. I said, I'm sure it's not, to talk about what stock Gore holds. But within minutes, we got a call back from the White House answering questions from their point of view, and then further officials calling us, although they said they would not go on the record. But what they did say is that Gore really has just learned about the UWA situation. Now, I raised the issue of Gore meeting with the winner of the Goldman Prize in 1998. Is that right? And they said, well, those things can just be a photo op. Was there any conversation that went on between the spokesperson for the UWA and Vice President Gore?
Yeah, my understanding of that meeting is that when Burrito Kuwar Uwa, who is the spokesperson for the Uwa people, began to mention the fact that it was Occidental Petroleum that was the threatening corporation on his land, the vice president excused himself quickly and had to leave the room for unclear reasons. So that's just one example. The vice president has also gotten thousands of letters that came off of a full-page New York Times ad in 1998 on this issue.
They said they get tens of thousands of letters, so they don't remember.
Sierra Club Executive Director Carl Pope just wrote him 3 months ago on this issue. The Coalition for Amazonian Peoples and the Environment wrote him a letter 2 years ago on this.
They said environmental groups have never requested to meet on this issue.
That's not true.
Well,
not true.
I'd like to ask Peter Eisner. Peter, how did Gore acquire this large stake in Occidental?
Well, it has a lot to do with his father's relationship with Armand Hammer, the late founder of Occidental. His father, after Al Gore Sr., after he left the Senate, was immediately hired by Occidental as a consultant to the tune of several hundred thousand dollars. Armand Hammer liked to say that he had Al Gore Sr. in his back pocket. During Senate campaigns, both Gores were flown around frequently by Occidental jets. As a matter of fact, there's another piece of information about Al Gore Jr., which is that Occidental leases some land from him, which has rich zinc and other trace mineral deposits, and he's been getting $20,000 a year, a check for $20,000 a year, most years, for the lease of that land. By the way, on the Elk Hills question, it's true to say that there was a bidding process for that to be purchased, but it's not true to say that it was an open bidding process. Very interesting that a precedent was set in the Elk Hills sale. Many precedents were set, but one was that it was a closed bidding process, and we still haven't been able to take a look at what the bids were. It is also true that the Occidental sale for $3 billion plus was almost double what the government was expecting, and the government says that by having a sealed bid, the price will go up because no one else knows each other's bid. But it's also true that it's never been done before, and even now, after the fact, we're not able to get a look at what the bids were.
We have to break for a minute for stations to identify themselves, then we're going to wrap up in a few minutes on this issue that we will continue to cover at Gore's connection to Occidental Petroleum. After that, we're going to have a discussion about the SATs and how kids are getting to take them in a 4.5-hour exam period rather than 3 hours. But there's only a certain kind of kid who gets to do that. Then we will go to talk about the UN Security Council meeting that will be taking place on Monday on the Congo. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guests are Peter Eisner of the Center for Public Integrity and Steve Kretzmann, the consultant to the UWOC campaign of Amazon Watch. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and we wish we were also here with a representative of the Gore campaign or of the White House explaining Vice President Al Gore's connection to Occidental Petroleum. We're talking with Peter Eisner, who is with the Center for Public Integrity, and Steve Kretzmann in California, who is a consultant to the UWOC campaign of Amazon Watch. Public Integrity put out a book just a couple weeks ago, The Buying of the President 2000, the authoritative guide to the big money interests behind this year's presidential candidates. And in it, it talks about this vast sale the Energy Department has made of the 47,000-acre Elk Hills Reserve to Occidental Petroleum Corporation, the largest privatization of federal property in U.S. history, one that tripled Occidental's U.S. oil reserves overnight. I know Steve Kretzmann has to go as he heads to New Hampshire, but first, Juan, you had a quick question for Peter Eisner.
Yes, Peter, Occidental is linked not just to Al Gore in the Gore campaign, right? There's a you've uncovered a link also with Tony Coelho, the chief of the vice president's presidential campaign. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's also true, Juan. In the course of looking at the sale of Elk Hills, for instance, we found that the environmental impact statement for the sale was farmed out to ICF Kaiser, which is a consulting firm whose board of directors includes Tony Coelho and the former Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary. One interesting thing about that was that the Environmental Protection Agency asked for information about PCBs being stored at Elk Hills. You may remember that PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, a lot of talk about that in the Hudson River in the 1970s from General Electric, one of the most poisonous chemicals known, usually found in huge electrical transformers. The Environmental Protection Agency found that there were stores of PCBs on the Elk Hills site, and they wanted to know what was going to be done about it. The ICF Kaiser, acting as the Environmental Review Board, simply didn't answer, and nor did the Department of Energy, so we don't know what happened to the PCBs. And, by the way, that whole process controlled by this ICF Kaiser, which includes Coelho, was sped up beyond most known environmental reviews, as people close to the situation saying that it was really more or less a rubber stamp rather than taking a look at environmental impact.
It's interesting that this private company, ICF Kaiser, that was paid to complete the assessment, General Chair of Gore's presidential campaign, Tony Coelho, sitting on the board of directors, when our producer, Maria Carrion, talked to a White House spokesperson, they said that at the time, Vice President Gore didn't know Tony Coelho.
Might be so, might not be so, but the fact is that what we're dealing here with is a connection of sweetheart business deals in which a certain sector of the business world tends to benefit, whether the individuals know one another or not.
Last comment to Steve Kretzmann as you head off to New Hampshire. Are we going to see a campaign like we saw with the AIDS activists around Vice President Gore's involvement with pushing U.S. drugs, AIDS drugs that were too expensive for people in Africa, where everyone was putting up these signs that said Gore greed kills, and it ultimately forced him to meet with the activists?
He's not going to be able to get away from us in New Hampshire. We're going to be dogging him everywhere he goes.
Well, Steve Kretzmann heading off to New Hampshire from Berkeley, California, consultant to the UWA campaign of Amazon Watch, and Peter Eisner. He's with Center for Public Integrity, which just put out the big report on all the candidates, The Buying of the President 2000, the authoritative guide to the big money interests behind this year's presidential candidates. That website, if you want more information, is www.publicintegrity.org. And the website for Amazon Watch, Steve Kretzmann?
www.amazonwatch.org.
Well, thanks both for being with us. As we move quickly now to another issue that is getting some attention, some very good pieces in the Los Angeles Times over the last few days. This week, members of the University of California's Regents called for a review of the SATs. They're concerned that too many white affluent students are gaining an unfair advantage on the exam. The Regents were responding to an article in the January 9th edition of the LA Times. The story reported that half the number of students claiming a learning disability, a factor which increases the amount of time a student has to take the exam. There's a concern that too many high school students from privileged families are taking advantage of the system. The University of California weighs a student's grades and SAT scores heavily when determining admission to its colleges, particularly in the case of the more competitive campuses such as Berkeley and UCLA. This is questions are being raised about the validity of the SAT overall, claims of race and gender bias in the exam, and its role. Is it really a predictor of success in college? We're joined right now by Mark Sclaro, who is Executive Director of Independent Educational Consultants Association in Fairfax, Virginia, Rhoda Benedetti, attorney with the Disability Rights Advocates. Mark Sclaro, can you lay out what you think the issue is?
Well, the issue is really this. It was a great plan, and it makes a great deal of sense that students that have a learning disability have special accommodations when they take the SATs. Give one very clear example. A student who is blind may need someone to fill in the ovals for them, or may need someone, obviously, to read the SATs to them. Increasingly, families are looking for untimed tests or longer tests, extra time for a student with a learning disability. And again, in theory, it's terrific. It helps to level the playing field. But as you said in the intro, the real problem is that families that have learned how to work the system are getting those special accommodations, especially untimed tests or longer test time that don't have any evidence of a learning disability.
Well, one of the things uncovered in the Los Angeles Times article that really has touched off this controversy is that there's been an explosion of requests for more time by, especially in the Boston, New York, Washington corridor for students from elite private schools who in some of these schools, as many as a tenth of the students who are taking the test are requesting the particular extra time because of a disability, and that there are almost no students in inner city schools that are requesting this. So that obviously this is leading to advantages for certain income groups in the country, or at least it's still a small number. Rhoda Benedetti, attorney with the Disability Rights Advocates in Oakland, California, what's your response to the revelations of the LA Times?
Well, we're largely dismayed about this article, which just extremely distorts the nature of learning disabilities. It casts a negative characterization on children with learning disabilities as upper income game players, and this is just dead wrong on the facts, and it's an insult, really. It's a sensationalized and irresponsible journalistic piece, which we really wouldn't expect of a newspaper of the caliber of the LA Times. And first and foremost, we need to understand that learning disabilities are real disabilities. I mean, you don't have to be blind or use a wheelchair to have a disability. These are not make-believe disabilities. In fact, research by the National Institute of Health shows that approximately 17% of the general population has a learning disability, These are the result of a central nervous system dysfunction, which impedes the ability to learn certain skills such as reading, writing, and spelling.
But, Rhoda, does it make sense that kids particularly concentrated in New England prep schools are suffering from this disability as opposed to kids in Compton and South Central?
Well, the fact is that learning disabilities run across every race, gender, age, and socioeconomic group. It's really no surprise to us, however, that you're seeing children who are at the more privileged end of the economic spectrum actually utilizing these accommodations, because these are going to be kids that are more likely to have better access to resources to be diagnosed, receive treatment, and to be aware of their rights to receive accommodations. Whereas children, at the lower end of the socioeconomic level simply don't have, under our current system, access to the kind of documentation, the costly kind of documentation that is necessary to obtain such accommodations on the SAT.
We're also joined by Robert Schaefer from the public he's a public education director of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, and they've been involved in legal actions against the college boards and the Educational Testing Service for race and gender bias. What's your reaction to these articles by the L.A. Times?
I think both the other speakers are correct in a manner. Yes, the L.A. Times story goes overboard, exaggerating the problem. But yes, too, there are kids and their parents who are using this as another leg up on the SAT, but to boost their scores on the SAT by getting additional time. But the real issue from perspective is, why do we continue to use this stupid test, a test which has manifest gender and racial biases, one in which you can increase your scores by getting extra time or by getting coaching or whatever? It's not a level playing field. It's not very useful in the process. And as Amy said, it is something that is very important in admissions in some colleges, like the University of California at Berkeley. Indeed, FairTest is working closely with a number of civil rights suits in a lawsuit against Berkeley for racial bias in its admissions process, precisely because it relies so heavily on SAT scores.
What's the racial bias?
The racial bias is that the test often declares that young people are unable to perform at high levels in college work, when in fact they are. It looks at how well you fill in bubbles for 3 hours on a Saturday morning and makes conclusions about your overall mental capacity. It's simply not very accurate. The test makers themselves admit that the SAT is a less accurate predictor of how well someone's going to do in college than their high school performance was, grades or test scores. And people say, well, you can't use them because grades are all over the lot and schools vary in quality. And that's true. Yet the test makers say that those are better predictors than their own test is, showing how truly lousy the test is as a predictive tool.
We only have a few minutes, but if you could just very briefly, Robert Schaefer, tell us the history of the College Board, which puts out the SAT.
The history is extraordinarily ugly. The first secretary of the College Board, Carl Campbell Brigham, was a very prominent eugenicist, a person who believed that whites and males were intellectually superior. He was the president of the American Eugenics Association, and wrote a number of books and pamphlets, which he later recanted 7 or 8 years later, which held that the intellectual quality of the American public was being dumbed down by immigrants. And by that he meant darker people from Southern Europe, Mediterraneans, Jews, and Negroes, to use his terminology. Women didn't matter at all in his mind, since they were clearly intellectually inferior. The roots are in very ugly notions of mental measurement that have now proven to be bogus and fundamentally racist. That's not to say that people who run the College Board today hold views like that, but their test is rooted in those kinds of notions.
Well, in many inner cities now, in New York, in many in California, in Texas now, this issue of standards and tests has been increasingly used to make it even harder now to admit minority students, African Americans, and Latinos into universities. I'm a little perturbed, Rhoda Benedetti, when you say that it's not surprising that people from higher income backgrounds might be able to more know their rights in terms of disabilities. But the inner city schools are filled with children who are in learning disabled classes. Aren't you a little shocked that the college boards or the school officials haven't made more of an effort to let them know what their rights are as disabled students?
Well, certainly. I think it's a major problem, but I would disagree with your statement that the schools are full lower socioeconomic areas are full of children with learning disabilities, because, in fact, children living in poverty are extremely underdiagnosed, as are girls, with learning disabilities. There are thousands and thousands of these children out there who have never been diagnosed and treated. In fact, it's estimated that as many as 30% of the children who live in poverty actually have learning disabilities. So it's a major issue that these kids are not being properly diagnosed and treated.
Mark Sclaro, isn't for the white boys that are doing this, and again, there may be a number of them who actually have a disability, but isn't there a stigma put on taking the exam in 4.5 hours instead of 3? I mean, does it really help them get a leg up into a college?
Actually, the evidence is it helps them a great deal. Test scores tend to go up an average of 100 points. And when students take an untimed test or have a longer period of time.
But you still have a star in your name.
You have an asterisk next to your score. And College Board actually did some research and found that about half of college admission officers never notice the asterisk. And those that do often favor those students over others, trying to create a diverse campus. So there's some indication that there's no great stigma attached, and it's the reason that parents of kids who, even those that some who do not have disabilities, are seeking that. But one quick
thing. Do they need a medical excuse?
Well, early on in the process, yes, you needed to demonstrate historically that there was a learning disability and the student was receiving accommodations. But there were so many applications and so many appeals to the College Board that most of those decisions are now allowed to be made by the school principal. And the problem with making the decision there is it's to the school's benefit to grant the student extra time. It makes the school look better as student scores go up and students are accepted at better colleges and universities. I mean, it really does get at the root of what Mr. Schaefer was saying, that is the system is unquestionably unfair. But the problem is that the tests are actually being used more by colleges and universities today than they were even 10 years ago as a determinant in who is admitted.
So what could be done to rectify this situation? While it is not, as everyone has said, it's only about 2% of the students who take the test who are applying for this. But what can be done to remedy the situation to assure fairness for everybody?
Well, Juan, as you're saying, it's only 2% nationally, but it's as high as 20 or 25% in some schools. What there really needs to be is a fair system where students need to document the learning disability. My concern would be that if colleges begin to discount this because of some cheaters, then kids who legitimately need the accommodations are going to have their scores discounted, and that would be a great shame for those kids. So what we really need to do is to make sure that standard rules are applied for kids across the board, as well as we need to educate counselors and teachers in poorer communities and in the inner city to make sure that those kids who should be getting those accommodations are given the opportunity.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us and also give people a chance to get in touch with you. Robert Schaefer, you're in Florida, National Center for Fair and Open Testing. How can people find your group?
The best way is through our website, www.fairtest.org. And our main office is in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Your phone number there?
617-864-4810.
That's 617-864-4810. Mark Sclaro, Executive Director, Independent Educational Consultants Association.
Well, first, we have a toll-free number. It's 1-800-808-4322. Our website, www.fairtest.org. educationalconsulting.org.
That's 1-800-808-4322. And Rhoda Benedetti of Disability Rights Advocates.
Yes, our number is 510-451-8644. And we have a website at www.dralegal.org.
And that's 510-451-8644. Thank you all very much for being with us. When we come back, the Congo. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of people have been killed and more than 150,000 people have fled from fighting in northeastern Congo. This according to Médecins Sans Frontières, the aid agency, Doctors Without Borders, which won the Nobel Peace Prize this year. At the same time, it looks like Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, will be chairing a UN Security Council meeting on Monday, attended by African leaders to discuss peace in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The U.S. is pushing initiatives on African problems during its presidency of the Security Council and has invited the six presidents who signed the Lusaka Accords on Peace in the Congo last summer to attend the New York meeting. Among those who will be there is Congolese President Laurent Kabila. We're joined right now by two people who are from the Congo, concerned about the situation there. Our guest on the telephone is Mulegwa Zihindula. He is a graduate student in conflict resolution at Eastern Mennonite University in Harrisburg, Virginia, and a consultant for the General Board of Global Ministries, the United Methodist Church. We're also joined in studio by Lubangi Munyanya, who is a representative of the Congolese community here in New York and is the former director of education at the Museum for African Art in New York. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Lubangi Munyanya, could you lay out what you think the issue is? What is the Security Council going to be dealing with on Monday?
Well, I think what the Security Council will be dealing with on Monday is try to actually start a ceasefire in the Congo. But the concern that the Congolese people have is that before we talk about the ceasefire, really, we want to identify the aggressor so they can leave the Congo. And then we can talk about the ceasefire.
Mulegwa, you have recently been in the Congo, have gone back and forth. You write reports for the United Methodist Church. What's your assessment on the ground there? And would you agree with what Lubangi is saying?
I mean, I know what the Security Council is going to be doing, which is pretty much to try to enforce the ceasefire that is supposed to be in place. As you know, there was a peace accord signed on July 10th between the belligerents. But the ceasefire has
the belligerents
not,
are who?
The belligerents, that means the Rwandan, Ugandan government and the so-called Congolese rebels against the Army of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And so there's supposed to be a ceasefire between them since July 10th, but, you know, really there's evidence that the ceasefire has not been respected very much. And so I think what this Security Council wants to do is to try to see how this ceasefire can be enforced. But I believe that there is no way this ceasefire can be enforced unless the United States should really take a big role because, you know, the United States, we know that it has a very good relationship with both Rwanda and Uganda. And they need to pretty much tell them to remove their troops from Congo, and I think this is the best solution. As to my assessment of the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the situation is pretty critical. I visited some displaced people's camps and so on and so forth, and the situation is very critical. The economic situation has gone really bad. The country has been partitioned. Food that used to come from the eastern part of the country does not come to the rest of the country anymore because Rwanda and Uganda hold the eastern part of Congo.
Give us some context for listeners around this country, the United States. We hear very little about Africa in general, let alone the Congo. How big is the Congo? And in terms of the resources in the Congo, what is at issue here? Lubangi.
Just to give you an idea, the Congo is the third largest country in Africa. Six times, if not eight, the size of France, and 80 times the size of Belgium. It is geographically, Congo is situated right in the heart of Africa. And strategically, we're talking about a country that is able to reach out to all the surrounding countries in Central Africa.
It borders on how many countries? Something like eight?
Nine countries.
Yes. Like?
Nine countries. Angola, Central Africa Republic, Tanzania, Zambia, Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, Sudan, Congo, the Republic of Congo, Brazzaville.
And in terms of who is supporting who, you've got Laurent Kabila, the president of the Congo, backed by Zimbabwe, Namibia, Angola.
Right.
And then you've got Rwanda and Uganda. I was speaking to Professor Horace Campbell from Syracuse University.
Sure. Mm.
And when I used the term Rwanda and Uganda invaded Congo,
right,
he objected.
Well, see, what Congolese people do not understand is that's exactly what that type of attitude, because we all know that, Congo is a country that obviously everybody knows that has been invaded by Rwanda and Uganda. As we are talking right now, you can actually see the presence, the physical presence of the Rwandan army in the Congo. Ugandan army in the Congo. They are fighting using their own country's flag.
He didn't disagree that they're in there. I think he disagreed about using the term invaded because he felt that they were somehow rescuing.
Well, you know, I don't know what he meant by rescuing, you know, because, you know, I'm from eastern Congo and I know what happened on August 2nd, 1998. I don't know what he means by rescuing. You know, what actually happened, if I can give you a brief situation about what happened on August 2nd, is that, first of all, the whole situation began on July 29th. Rwanda and Uganda had been involved in the war in 1996, you know, which was to help to overthrow the, you know, the government of dictator Mobutu Sese Seko. But having helped us to overthrow Mobutu Sese Seko, they felt that they had certain rights in the country. But on July 29th, when Laurent Kabila, the president of Congo, asked them to go back to their respective country, Rwanda and Uganda both invaded eastern Congo, including my hometown of Bukavu. So I don't know exactly what they were coming to rescue in Congo. You know, that's something that I don't really understand what they
Nobody
were coming to rescue.
That.
And since then, as you know, I mean, there are reports. I have reports from MISNA, the Catholic news agency based in Rome, about some of the massacres, some of the atrocities that they are committing in Congo. So I don't know who they are coming to rescue.
Why does Uganda and Rwanda say they invaded?
Well, you know, presumably for security reasons. They say it's for security reasons.
And why? What do you mean security reasons?
Well, they say that, rebels from their own countries have been using bases inside Congo to destabilize the country, to destabilize their own countries. You know, but this is not true because most of the rebellions, like the rebellion in Rwanda, is based in a town called Ruhengeri. Now, Ruhengeri does not have a border with Congo. Ruhengeri has a border with Uganda. So if the rebels are coming from somewhere, it would be from Uganda. And even though they occupy now eastern Congo, you know, and a large part of our country, you know, they still have these rebellions inside their country. So having come and invaded Congo has not stabilized their own situation.
We're talking to Mulegwa Ziendula, who is a graduate student at Eastern Mennonite University in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and he also works with the United Methodist Church going back and forth to the Congo. He is Congolese himself. Also joining us in the studio is Lubangi Munyanya, and he will be outside the United Nations on Monday. There's going to be a large Congolese protest with people coming from around the country, although it is not clear whether President Laurent Kabila will be there, is it?
Yes, we were told that President Kabila indeed received an invitation from the United Nations. And the word was that he will be there. I was told that yesterday.
Well, you are both talking about the importance of U.S. involvement here
yes.
to mediate a solution because of the U.S.'s close relationship with Rwanda and Uganda.
Correct.
But what gives you any faith, considering that it was the United States that supported Mobutu Sese Seko for so long,
right.
the dictator that pillaged the country to the tune of, $4 billion, maybe it was a lot more than that, and that's just the corruption. Then you've got the level of brutality against the people for decades.
Well, if I may go first, I will say that, first of all, Mobutu is gone, and Kabila came under the, he came in and he, you know, we all believe that he came in to help liberate the country from this mad dictator that we all call Mobutu. But unfortunately, the country is in a situation that we are having difficulty to rebuild it. We all know that Rwanda, Uganda, they've been backed by the United States. That's a fact. Why? Because there have been instances where, you know, people, actually soldiers who were in the field that I've spoken to, I will say even my brother was one of the soldiers.
He was.
My brother was. And he still is a soldier now. He was one of the first soldiers who were fighting in Bunia.
Congolese soldier supported by?
No, Congolese soldier who was fighting for the country. But they were so surprised to see the type of physical presence that the Ugandan and Rwanda army had. In their knowledge, it had to be something more than just those countries.
In terms of how they were armed?
How they were armed and how well organized they were, because it just came out of a terrible, terrible situation, as you know, the genocide and the war. And how much time did they have to rebuild the army and to reorganize an army to go invade another country and actually progress until a few kilometers Kinshasa. They were really, literally, almost in Kinshasa to overthrow the government of Kabila. So this really blew everybody's mind away. Actually, witnesses did tell us that there were some higher power involvement in this progression of Rwandan and Ugandan army.
Malegwa Zindula, what do you say about those that talk about the atrocities of Laurent Kabila in terms of massacres?
Well, you know, if people are talking about Kabila committing massacres, you know, people still need to prove to me or to anybody from the Congolese civil society, which I'm also a member of, that Kabila has committed any massacres. The people who are committing massacres, and they have been proven by everybody in the field, the massacres being committed are being committed in the eastern part of Congo. Kabila does not hold the eastern part of Congo. The eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo is being held by Rwanda and Uganda. You know, and, you know, we have witnesses. You know, we have the Catholic Church that has documented many of these massacres. For instance, one massacre happened on August 24th, 1998. Rwandan soldiers killed 1,099 people in one village because these people refused to pledge allegiance to them. On New Year's Eve, 1999, they massacred 500 people in another village, in a fishing village in South Kivu. So we have these documented massacres. You know, I think for people to say that Kabila is committing massacres in Congo, there is no proof whatsoever. You know, and I'm not here to support Kabila. You know, I don't work for Kabila. As you know, I work for the United Methodist Church. But the fact is a fact. And so these are untrue stories about Kabila committing massacres.
Well, what then do you think can happen? Again, this point of the U.S. having been on the side of Rwanda and Uganda, having been on the side of Mobutu Sese Seko, why do you think they can play a positive role now?
Well, you know, I think the United States really has a moral obligation, you know, to do what is right in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You know, it's against international law for one country to invade another country. And the United States is aware that Rwanda and Uganda had invaded the Democratic Republic of Congo. I think the United States has a moral obligation after having supported a dictator like Mobutu for many years. They owe it to the Congolese people. I mean, Congolese people have had a short end of the stick, you know, since 1885 when we were colonized by Belgium, and then we had a Mobutu's rule for 32 years. You know, and I think it's an obligation of the United States as the leader of the free world, you know, to allow us to live, to allow our people to live. All the Americans have to do is go to Congo and see how much Congolese people are suffering as a result of this.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's affected. I mean, we who live here in America are very affected because we have to actually be on the phone all the time with the families and then try to help our families from here. It's affecting our lives, affecting our morals, and this is really just wrong. And
how many Congolese live here in the United States?
I don't have the exact numbers, but there is a growing number of our Congolese community who are actually coming for this Monday, January 24th. They're coming from North Carolina. They're coming from the West Coast. They're coming from Canada. We also have a delegation of people that are coming from Japan. You have to understand that Congolese are very mad, and they feel like United States has, like my compatriot said, has a moral obligation to try to end this massacre.
What do diamonds have to do with this, or do they?
Diamonds have a lot to do with this.
I want to get in touch with either of you around the protests on Monday outside of the UN Security Council in New York City, where Madeleine Albright will be presiding over the meeting attended by African leaders to discuss the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Where can they call? Lubangi Munyanya.
Yes, right now there is one number, and then that number can tell you exactly where you can go. It's 201-963-6610.
One more time.
201.
201.
Right. 963-6610.
If anybody wants to email me, they can email me at chahi@aol.com.
That's chahi@aol.com. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Malegwa Zianjula is a graduate student in conflict studies at Eastern Mennonite University in Harrisburg, Virginia, also consultant with the United Methodist Church, the General Board of Global Ministries, going back and forth to the Congo, where he was born. And in the studio here in New York, we've been joined by Lubangi Munyanya, former director of education at the Museum of African Art. He, too, will be outside the United Nations on Monday. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!